Veritex Community Bank Studios. ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
What up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
He's Joel, I'm Jeremy. It is a Wednesday edition of The Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Astros even up the series yesterday. 9-2 victory over the Red Sox at Fenway in Game 4 of the ALCS. The series not over between the Astros and the Red Sox. Closer game, of course, than the final score indicated. Red Sox led for the majority of it. The Astros get the solo shot by Bregman over the monster in the top of the first. Zach Greinke, another walk coming back to haunt the Astros. Bogaerts hitting the two-run shot in the bottom of the first. That, surprisingly, was the score all the way into the top of the eighth inning. Jose Altuve, first pitch swinging, hits a bomb over the Green Monster, tied the game at two, and then the Astros break it open in the ninth. Jason Castro, a two-out RBI single, giving the Astros the lead, and then they would just tack on, and go on to a 9-2 victory over the Red Sox. Look, a lot of nervous moments in that game yesterday, and you had the sense. If the Red Sox get out 3-1, they have another game at Fenway today. They have two more games in Houston if it gets back to that point. It wasn't a must-win yesterday, but it was pretty darn close to a must-win yesterday at Fenway.
Absolutely it was. And you know what? The thing is that you can compare and contrast the four games in the series and say, well, the Red Sox won both of theirs definitively. They were dominant. They just crushed the Astros, and the Astros just found a way to win in the two games that they won, and the score is not indicative of how close of a game it was last night. But you know what? As we keep saying and kept saying when they were getting their butt handed to them by the Red Sox in games two and three, it doesn't matter how you get it done. At the end of the day, win by 10, win by 1, just win. Now we're into a three-game series. Two of those three are going to be played at Minute Maid Park, assuming that you don't crap the bed now. So you've got to continue to handle business. And Charlie goes over the top anti-momentum, but we've been saying all along, look, you can sit there and all of a sudden declare series over because things didn't go your way in game three. But it's just as quickly as you could say series over, you know what? Series on. Now that we saw what we saw last night, I think the difference, Jeremy, that I kept thinking throughout the game and looking at how the series has progressed to this point, it's a tale of two teams with two different ways of scoring runs. We know the Red Sox hit home runs, and that is the name of the game for them. But they capitalize on the Astros' mistakes, which is walks, right? So the more the Astros pitchers walk Red Sox hitters, the more dangerous the situation. On the flip side, two-out base hits have been the key to everything the Astros have been able to do in this series, and there you get the tale of the two teams and how they score runs.
Storyline for me was the heroics late in the game. Carlos Correa in the ninth inning, the leadoff doubles. Some controversy there, at least if you're listening to Joe Buck, who was roasting Carlos Correa in the ninth inning for loafing it out of the box, which I didn't think was very fair. And then he was banging on Correa for not taking third base on a ball that barely got away from the Red Sox catcher. Didn't think that was all that fair. But then Jason Castro with a two-out RBI single, heroics off the bench for Castro, came on earlier in the game and had a line shot, too, right to the first baseman, Kyle Schwarber. The heroics of Jose Altuve, who, by the way, now is has the third most home runs in postseason history.
It's crazy.
And the most of any infielder in Major League Baseball history. More than Jeter, if you can believe that. He's been certainly a big factor for the Astros in these playoff runs these last several years. But the bullpen, my goodness, this bullpen who has been, I think, fairly criticized all season. I think even after July 31st, whenever James Click did improve the bullpen with trades for Kendall Graveman, trades for Yimi Garcia, but the bullpen, unbelievable. 7 2/3 innings, shutout baseball, they strike out 10, and Christian Javier, I mean, he was outstanding for the Astros yesterday. 3 shutout innings, striking out 3, and he's continuing his postseason dominance. 3 appearances now for Javier, 7 2/3, has not allowed a run, and has struck out 13. Javier, I think Joe Buck described it well, has been the ace in the hole for the Houston Astros bullpen.
I'll say this, Jeremy, depending on what happens with this series, if they get to the World Series, I think Javier's a starter in the next round.
Might be in Game 7.
Yeah, and it's also possible, like you said, in Game 7, but I think no matter what, you know that you already had him solidified as a starter for next season because he was a starter before things got a little crazy with all the starters this season. But what he showed you is he is another reliable arm that Dusty can go to, and we know how much he loves those kind of guys. And even the guy that I've been highly critical with a lot of good reason throughout the season, Brooks Raley steps up big. Everybody, as much as Dusty has been, and again, well-deserved, much maligned in the way he's handled his bullpen and the pitchers that he's gone to and when he's gone to them, he has pushed all the right buttons in this series. He pushed them again last night, whether you thought Greinke should have come out or not. He was close to the end anyway. You could tell that he just didn't have it. He wasn't even upset when he came out like he would have been in Game 7 against the Nationals in the World Series. And then every single guy was next man up, and every single guy handled their business. We didn't have a blowout. We didn't have a slugfest. We had a 2-1 game. And just like Game 1, I did not feel good about that game until I did. And once I did, oh my goodness, what they're able to do for you that helps is, just like in Game 1 when they added on the extra insurance run, they ended up needing it because Presley gave up a home run in the ninth. Last night, one was not enough. And they just kept on piling on, and it was beautiful to see an Astros team that really, you could tell, from a momentum standpoint, is one thing, but just from a team morale standpoint, it was just unbelievably unlifting throughout that clubhouse. There was a newfound vigor in that clubhouse. I look to see that again today.
Hey, I'm not going to lie. I mean, during the middle of that game, it looked like the Astros swinging for the fences, and Altuve did and got one there in the eighth. But you had some belief there that the Astros weren't going to be able to scratch another run off of the Red Sox bullpen. They do. And how about that backdoor overcover, huh? 7 runs in the ninth. The total was 10. You end up at 11 runs in that game thanks to that seven-run ninth inning for the Astros. Dusty Baker, after the game, speaking about the victory.
This is what, you know, enjoying baseball, you know, as if you're a child. And, you know, this is one of the great things about baseball. I mean, you know, when you're dead seemingly in the water and things aren't going good, then all of a sudden, boom, 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 and you got 7 runs. And, you know, that's what they've been doing to us this whole series. And, you know, we're capable of doing that as well.
Momentum can flip like that. Series can flip like that. Going into yesterday's game, I mean, Cody Stoops, I mean, he was tweeting about it. Series over after Game 3. Astros don't have the pitching to get even in the series and make it a competitive series again. He wasn't the only one saying that. But
panic.
The Astros get it done yesterday. They even the series and flip the script just like that. Now you have Fromber on the mound in Game 5, and you just hope that Fromber has what's close to a Fromber-like game.
That's my question.
I mean, he's the best starter you have right now.
Absolutely, but you don't have any starters right now. I mean, the futility from the starters is just, it's record-setting. When you talk about, you know, not having one starter be able to get through 3 complete innings in an American League Championship Series, that's embarrassing.
Yeah.
And so you have to try and reevaluate, and you got to reshuffle the deck on the fly, and the one guy that you have to point a finger at and go, I need you. I really need you to be somewhere close to where you were in the regular season is Fromber, because with Fromber and a Fromber that's able to be effective and get you 5 or 6, boy, are you in a good position, especially coming home for the final 2. If Fromber is another disaster for 2 1/3 or 2 2/3 or whatever it might be, with as much as this bullpen has been taxed over the last 2 games, you really got a question. Presley was supposed to be in and out last night. I saw your tweet. I was thinking the same thing. I don't know that I even would have used him last night, because the last thing you wanted to see is exactly what you ended up seeing. He went over 20 pitches. He should still be fine today. You got 2 innings out of Graveman, so I wouldn't expect a whole bunch out of him. The bullpen has been used a lot.
So is the Red Sox bullpen on the other side of that argument, too. I'm with you. I wouldn't have used Presley in that spot once you took the 7-run lead. You can understand he hasn't thrown since Game 1. You want to get him out there. But the fact that he went over 20 pitches was something that was discouraging, at least from my point of view. I think everybody's available today with the exception
of
Javier.
You have Stanek. Yeah. You assume you have another day of Presley.
I think you can get an inning out of Graveman, too. I mean, he threw 30
pitches.
I understand,
but remember at the end of the year how much they were all worried and concerned about back-to-back days and how many days you can pitch him. And again, it wasn't a 1-inning stint for him last night. It was 2.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you're right, but I'd be a little leery of pushing that button.
I wouldn't have him as the unavailable, though, right? Like, it's probably like an emergency situation or you have to have him situation. Threw 30 pitches yesterday. Presley threw 22. Yes, he went that extra inning, but only threw 8 more pitches than Presley did. I don't think you can get more than one for Graveman. I don't think you can get more than one from Presley. And I'm not even setting the bar high for Fromber Valdez, because I agree with everything that you had to say. Like, give me 5 innings, 3 runs. You would take that right now from Fromber Valdez. 5 innings, 3 runs, keep the offense in the game, because the Red Sox are in pretty bad shape as well. Controversy, of course, in yesterday's game. Any good playoff game has a little bit of controversy in baseball. Ahead of the Jason Castro go-ahead RBI single in the ninth inning. Looked like home plate umpire Laz Diaz missed a pitch against Jason Castro that would have been strike three, inning over. You go to the bottom of the ninth, tied at two. The Astros got a break there. They got it a little bit prolonged in the at-bat. Castro delivered. Astros poured it on. Alex Cora asked after the game about that missed strike three to Castro.
Alex, you just had one pitch away. Did you think that was strike three, that one or two?
I got to take a look. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people thought it was a strike.
Do you think Nate was at all deflated by that or thrown off by that?
I mean, he was upset. Then he threw a fastball up. He fouled it off, and then he threw a split. And you know, he was a little bit in front and put a good swing. You know, Castro has put good at-bats against us throughout the series, right? The home run and the walk against Witt early on, and today he stayed back on that one, and against Witt hits the line right to first, and then that one he battled and he got the base hit.
Alex Cora taking the high road there, really no comment from him. Eovaldi said, look, I thought it was a strike, but you have to continue to pitch well in that spot. So the Red Sox taking the high road in that spot. I thought the Astros got a break, but them the breaks, that's part of baseball,
yeah,
right?
I mean, it's like whether you're getting the fringe calls or not, high in the zone, low in the zone, outsides, you know, corners, are you getting them, are you not? You know what? You just, all you can hope for is consistency, but you can't be in a position where you just all of a sudden think you got screwed. It is why it's human nature to be an umpire, and they have the ability to call it as they see it. And if he didn't see it, Laz Diaz didn't see it to be a strike, then it wasn't a strike. There's been plenty of calls the Astros have questioned on this playoff run and in games throughout the regular season, too. So the fact that this time it wasn't on them, when you look at it, when you evaluate it, even Jeff Passan, when you're talking about it, look, the fact is you can sit there and be critical of whether it should have been called a strike or not, but as it pertains to the actual strike zone, it was outside the zone. So you deal with it, you move on. You're Nathan Eovaldi. You're supposed to be their ace. You're supposed to be able to be okay with that. It's one pitch. Go out and use your best stuff and go get him anyway. It's Jason Castro. He's not supposed to be a big threat. You didn't do what you were supposed to do. He did. You lost. He won. Get over it.
I thought Eovaldi actually made a pretty good pitch to Castro, too. Castro just a little bit better job of hitting. Got it a little bit off the end of the bat. Placed it perfectly, which, you know, hit them where they ain't, as the old baseball saying goes. We always look at that ump scorecard from umpires the previous day. Laz Diaz yesterday got an 88% from overall accuracy. The average is 94%. Overall consistency, though, 97%, where the average is 96%. So, Laz Diaz, that's his strike zone. Something he was doing throughout the entire game. His consistency was very high. The Astros did get a favorable strike zone from Laz Diaz, according to this, plus 0.8 in the run differential between the two. The worst missed calls that he had, the most egregious from outside of the strike zone in terms of change in run expectancy, actually was Javier's pitch to Martinez earlier in the count. Called a ball. It was called a strike. It was a ball. Alex Cora came out, surprised he didn't get thrown out of the game there. And then the second most egregious call was the Eovaldi to Jason Castro there at the top of the ninth inning. The Astros get the victory. Laz Diaz behind the plate or not. I want to talk a little bit more about this controversy and how the national media is kind of framing what happened in yesterday's game. We'll get into that next. We'll get to your calls, your text, 713-780-3776, and some heroics from the Astros yesterday. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Your home for sports is ESPN 97.5. You're listening to The Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5, broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios.
Whitlock in his second inning out of the bullpen, and the first pitch to Altuve is a fly ball to left field, and it's gone. And how about that? On the first pitch of the eighth inning, Altuve lines a home run up over the monster, and the Astros have tied it. The crowd pausing for a moment as Eovaldi got the new ball. Now that he looks into the catcher, now that Castro digs back in, they get the noise ratcheted up again. 2-2 again, and a swing and a liner into center, a base hit. Correa around third on his way home. He will score. Around to third on the play is Gurriel. Jason Castro with an RBI single. and the Astros have taken the lead here in the top of the ninth.
Dan Shulman on ESPN Radio, who have the call again of Game 5 right here. ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5. First pitch right around 4 o'clock. Pregame coverage beginning at 3:30 right here on ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5. Castro, clutch. Jose Altuve outstanding to tie it up there in the top of the eighth inning. The Astro bats coming alive. Like, it's been something we've seen all the time from the Houston Astros this season. Like, they'll allow the A's to get close in the AL West. You start to get a little bit nervous about winning the division. You look at it in the ALDS. The White Sox win a big game 3. You know, things are starting to have negative momentum, if you want to believe into that. And the Astros come up big in game 4. Everybody was putting the Astros out of their misery after game 3, saying the starting pitching isn't there. Game 4, I think people were quitting on the offense a little bit, yet the Astros, again, revive the bats when you absolutely need to.
Well, and I'm not going to lie to you. I said it in the first segment. I felt awful until I didn't. I mean, all night long, I got home from my daughter's softball game in time to see the first inning. And when Bregman hit the home run, I'm like, there's what I asked for. I said, make sure you get on the board first. It'll send the initial message. Message sent. And then Greinke, both hands over his head to know that he just absolutely hung one. And Bogaerts rips it out of the yard. Whether you believe there was one of those controversial calls prior to that to put the first runner on base to give Bogaerts a two-run homer instead of a solo shot or not is a different story. But here we go. And you thought, well, that would open the floodgates and it would be a scoring bonanza. Instead, it was quite the opposite. But you never felt good as an Astros fan because even with Maldonado on with two outs, you thought, God, could he do it again? You got a little excited, but when he didn't, you thought, man, it's not going to be their night. Altuve's been scuffling with the exception of the one home run. And then when he comes up, when you absolutely need it again in the eighth inning, he just absolutely tees off and launches. And you're like, okay. Then the Correa right field. You know what? And you're right. It's one thing. It's like the Siri thing, right? Joe Buck, you can mention it once, maybe twice, but 18 times about Correa base running blunder. I hate to break this to you, Joey, but he scored. So just shut up.
Did you think that he should have been at third on that play?
I thought he could have been, but yeah. I think that the thing that they weren't factoring in that you needed to was the fact that that right fielder is not just any average right fielder out there. He's got a freaking cannon, and he could have hosed you and taken a chance to get that go-ahead run in. Instead, it could have put you in a very compromised position of not getting anything out of that inning. And therefore, just like you don't try and push it with two outs trying to stretch a double to a triple, if you're the leadoff guy and you get a chance to get to second base, you figure it within the next three outs, I can move him over, move him in, do what I need to do. But yeah, I was not overly upset by that.
I could have. Yeah, I think he could have. Should have. No, absolutely not. And you said it perfectly, and I think it showed Joe Buck's lack of baseball IQ there. You never, ever, ever make the first or third out at third base. And it was a tie game at that point. I mean, that's the go-ahead run. Absolutely. If you have 1% chance of being thrown out at third base out of the inning, do not do it.
Hunter Renfro, I believe, either led the league in putouts from the outfield, or he was close, and almost every single one of them was done with his arm. So you don't run on that guy when you don't have to. If you had to, there was two outs. Even still, you don't make the third out at third base. But in that situation, in a tie game, when you haven't exactly been lighting it up offensively, don't take yourself out of a possible scoring opportunity.
No, absolutely not. Altuve's precious already, especially in the ninth inning of a tie game in which you're trailing 2-1 in the series. To me, it was a no-go from the word go. And I wouldn't be surprised, too. Like, we didn't see Omar Lopez, what he was doing in the third base box. I wouldn't be shocked if he had the stop sign up as soon as the ball came off of Correa's bat. Buck then criticized Correa for not taking third base on that little ball that squirted away from Vasquez. Maybe, again, could have.
I think he could have got hosed there, too.
Exactly. Like, you're not risking that. Altuve too precious there. I thought Joe Buck was a little foolish whenever it came to that. The other angle to look at this in terms of, like, the national media perspective, that's a big game. Boston's a big team. They're a big market team. You have the East Coast bias. No sign of the Astros getting the victory here on the ESPN front page. The biggest ESPN baseball story from yesterday's game out of this series was Jeff Passan's story, where the headline writes how the 268th pitch became the defining moment of ALCS Game 4. Like, Elias Diaz didn't miss any of the previous 267 pitches. Like, it's crazy,
Jeremy,
how the stories get written about this series and how the angles and the bias against the Astros come into play.
23 missed strikes by Lance Diaz. If it was 21-2 in favor of misses for the Astros versus the Red Sox, you have a case. Do you know what the split was? It was 12 for the Red Sox, 11 for the Astros. If you want to tell me that that one pitch is the difference where they got screwed, go ahead and just absolutely bark it at me till you're blue in the face, but miss me with all of it, because you know what? It's human nature. It's umpiring in the major leagues. We constantly have over-evaluated and hyper-analyze it, but it is what it is. That's not the reason why they lost the game. If Uvaldi still makes the pitches he needs to make, we're not talking about the one pitch that he didn't get the call on and the plenty of others that the Astros didn't get either.
713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. If you want to get in, let's go out to the HRP listener line. Kevin, you're in the Hive with the Killer Bees.
How's it going, guys?
What's up, man?
Hey, man, I'm not a baseball guy. I'm more of a football guy, but I'm gonna make this short and sweet. I don't know what inning it was, but we had two men on base, and our catcher was up. He was ahead of the count 3-1. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why are this guy is why he don't want to take two pitches? You know, he hit his average is you guys know it's not really great in this. In the postseason, and I'm thinking like why he's swinging and why he just want to take two pitches, and would have the bases would have been loaded and Altuve would have been up, and because the Red Sox was like the next man up, they had that mentality, but you have the averages that you have as a catcher for us, and you're not hitting right. I was wondering why. You guys, I don't know what inning was. I'm like, why are you swinging at 3-1 pitch? That's all I have.
Appreciate it, Kev. Look, I know exactly what you're talking about. I don't think you look at strike three, right?
Well, it's 3-1 count.
Right, what I'm saying is, because he said take the next two.
Yeah.
I would take the 3-1 pitch no matter what and run your check. Because he wasn't accurate. He didn't have control of where he was throwing pitches at that point. So make him throw you one, and if he does, then you're still sitting fastball probably because they don't think you can hit the ball. You're still in an advantageous position. But I'm with them on the fact that instead of the pop-out, the weak pop-out, that he could have taken at least one more pitch.
I'm fine swinging 3-1. What I'm not fine is not guessing fastball and pulling it. Mm-hmm. Like, the fact that that was a weak fly out to center field was embarrassing to me. And it shows you where Maldonado's at the plate. You know for a fact, 3-1 count, two runners in scoring position, you're down by a run. You know for a fact the last thing they want to do is pitch to Jose Altuve. You know right. for a fact you're getting fastball. You know that there's a short porch in left field. How are you not guessing fastball and just daring him to throw breaking ball? And if you look foolish on a breaking ball, you tip your cap and you say, good job, you got me. But you should be yanking a 3-1 fastball, absolutely cheating for a fastball.
Here's the other thing that I don't understand, Jeremy. He's still got one of the longest swings in the lineup, and he shouldn't, right? If you're not hitting for average and power, then you need to change your swing, especially when you're, like you said, you're looking probably fastball. The one thing you want to do is make sure you catch up to it, and then if you can pull it, choke up a little bit to make sure you have the little extra bat speed, and you make sure you do what you need to do to make contact that's a solid contact, not a flailer out to center field. And I don't understand when he's struggling the way he is. There's ways, whether you change your whole entire approach or not from a hitting perspective, which is normally something you do in the offseason, you choke up. You see a lot of hitters do it, especially when they're scuffling. With two strikes, Anthony Rizzo is one of the kings of doing it. With two strikes, he chokes up about an inch on the end of the bat. And they asked him why. Because I make better contact that way. I have better bat control. You could do that and try and do something to shorten that swing. It's so long and loopy for a guy with no batting average that he has to at least try to make some kind of an adjustment.
Scary news earlier in the day yesterday, a plane that was headed to Boston to watch this game. It was carrying 21 Astro fans. It crashed on the runway. The plane was just, destroyed. It was terrible looking. Somehow all 21 survived this plane crash. I don't think that there's any major injury here as well.
No, there's two minor injuries.
But, thank goodness for that. Certainly happy to see no one got injured on that plane crash, which was, it looked awful.
Kudos to the crew, because from what I was told, Lisa was covering the story and had to cover it live for the most of the morning. They had a complete full fuel tank because they were going nonstop to Boston for the game. They had difficulties while they were on the runway. The pilot made the decision before he even tried to get it airborne because he was getting close to the end of the runway to pull up. They pulled up and then ended up skidding off the end of the runway. The crew was so diligent about getting everyone off as fast as they could. Everyone was completely off the plane before that full fuel tank caught fire. So what you saw was the remnants, but thankfully that was only after everyone had gotten off the plane. Great job by them.
Yeah, thank goodness everybody okay, and hope that they were watching the Astros last night. 713-780-3776 if you want to weigh in. We'll get to your calls and texts when we come back. Frank, you'll be first after the break. Also, the Astros lineup is out. Who's catching? Who's in center? We tell you next. Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
When it comes to sports betting, SportsMapBets.com is the site you need. From weekly betting guides to single game breakdowns of the point spread, money line, over under, and more, SportsMapBets has all the info you need to make the best play. SportsMapBets.com. You're listening to The Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5, broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios.
Get you the Astros lineup in 3 minutes. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Let's go out to the HR&P listener line. Frank, you're in the hive with The Killer Bees.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
What's up?
Hey, everyday listener, first-time caller.
Appreciate it.
First of all, first thing I want to say is, if you went to game two, do me a favor and don't show up to game six in Houston. Just going to put that out there. Second thing, what I'm trying to figure out is, if Jake Myers can't play, I'll tell you what, when we put in Almeides Diaz yesterday to pinch hit, they had a screenshot of Marwin in the dugout. I like Almeides. I'll go Marwin on that all day long. So if Jake's not going to play, why do we still have him sitting there? Not to mention we could have brought up another pitcher. Who that would have been, I don't know, but it's just another option for these three, you know, the 7 games in 9 days. Other than that, man, let's go Astros, get them tonight. How do you guys think Farmer's going to bounce back? I'll shut up and listen.
Appreciate the call, Frank. Thank you for listening to the Killer Bees and being a loyal listener. And I think Frank's point there, which I think might have been lost a little bit there, he's saying if Jake Myers is not able to go, then he should
then
not be on the roster.
Marwin's not on the roster right now. Yeah. You couldn't go to him.
I think that's what he was saying. He was saying that if Jake Myers really can't play at this point, then he shouldn't be on the roster. The downside of doing that is if you do advance to the World Series, that he wouldn't be eligible to play. If you have to get a guy off the roster because of an injury and have somebody take his spot mid-series, then he wouldn't be eligible to play the rest of the postseason. Now, I think it's a fair point if Jake Myers should have ever even been on the ALCS roster, because if he's not on the ALCS roster at the start of the series, then he could be placed on the World Series roster. So I think that's a fair point. I hated that spot to pitch hit for Diaz. And look, I know that the numbers probably tell you Diaz is slightly better against right-handed hitters than Chaz McCormick is. I don't think it's that big of a gap, and I hate bringing him in that spot cold where Chaz McCormick has seen some pitches
cold
throughout
against
the game.
A power pitcher that's going to bring upper 90s to the plate. And if you, I don't care if you were down in the cage just trying to get warm and trying to get loose. Chaz has seen pitchers all game long. He's in the moment. He's in the game. He doesn't have to warm up. He's ready to go. And what you're looking for there is someone to advance the runners, someone to possibly get a base hit. And we've seen this out of Aledmys Diaz before, where he comes off the bench cold, especially in environments like that. And I believe he did it in the White Sox series and just came up empty. That's the last thing you wanted to have happen. And that's why I'm the same way. I saw the switch going, and I'm like, I don't feel good about that. And the bigger point, you're right, is one with Jake Myers. Look, I understand you play hunches, Dusty, and we'll talk about the ones that he's playing today again, but I don't understand playing a hunch with the playoff roster. If Jake Myers is not 100%, if he's not 75%, we saw him when he actually hurt the shoulder and the arm initially, he was 50%. If you're not substantially better than that by the time the rosters need to be submitted, he should not be on the roster for this series.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And he was in the lineup yesterday and was a late scratch. Like, I wonder what went on at that point, because I think that they submitted it. Like, I don't know if it was a BP thing, because it happened pretty quickly.
I'm going to tell you what happened. They took infield, outfield, and they realized that throwing the ball, he still was very vulnerable and weak, and decided, nope, we can't take a chance with that.
If he can't start a game for you, do you take him off the roster? Like, knowing that he wouldn't be eligible to play in the World Series?
That's what I need to know from my medical people. Yeah. I need to know from my medical people, is this something he's going to recover from in the next 3 days, 5 days? If it's 2 weeks or more, or it's in that 2 week range, then I'm not taking any chances. I'm taking him off. I'm getting another body out there, whether I need defensive help, a pinch runner, or I need someone that's actually going to play 6 to 7 innings for me. I'm going to make the change right now, and I need my doctors to be honest with me. I don't need to talk to Jake because Jake's going to tell me he's going to be okay.
Yeah, I think if that is – I mean, I don't think it's going to happen at this point now that it's game five. You're late in the series. If it were to happen, I think Marwin Gonzalez is the guy that gets the call to be on the 26-man. Like, I saw some people on Twitter talking about, well, you should bring in another pitcher. Peter Solomon ain't saving the day, guys. Brandon Bielak ain't saving the day. Josh James ain't saving the day.
Please don't do that to me.
Yeah, I mean, but that was the right conversation yesterday. They should bring him in for another pitcher. Who, man? What pitch are you talking about that's going to be a factor in this series? I don't think so. All right, the Astros lineup is out for Game 5, and it's a little bit of a head-scratcher. Your top three the same. Altuve, Brantley in left field. Bregman in the three-hole. Your middle three, Yordan, Correa, Tucker. Your bottom three, Gurriel. Jose Siri gets another start in center field for the Astros against the lefty Chris Sale. And your catcher, Martin Maldonado, gets the start against Chris Sale of the Boston Red Sox. I'm okay with Martin Maldonado this spot. I think he is slightly a better receiver than Jason Castro. I don't trust Jason Castro a whole lot with breaking balls in the dirt. And he is, look, neither one's good against lefties. Martin Maldonado has slightly better numbers against lefties than Jason Castro.
I'm
going to
take a step further for you. I'm going to take two steps further. But one is, obviously the one thing he's going to do is throw runners out. Castro can't throw anybody out. That's a problem. The biggest reason why he's in the lineup today is Fromber. He's bilingual. He has the respect like a big brother to Fromber. When he goes out there between him and Correa, they double-team him, regardless of what language they double-team him in, to make sure that he stays within himself, that he refocuses, that he does what he needs to do. Jason Castro's not that kind of dude.
Yeah.
And that's not the kind of dude that Fromber needs today. He needs the tough love big brother coming out there.
I had a hyperbolic tweet yesterday that says I'd be okay if Martin Maldonado didn't have another at-bat the rest of the series. I admit it now in the moment. Look, I go Maldonado today as well. That said, as soon as Fromber is out of the game, in the very first at-bat you have against a right-handed reliever for the Boston Red Sox, I don't care if it's in the fourth inning, you bring Jason Castro in that spot. That. Now, the center fielder, Jose Siri, look, it's obvious Jake Meyers isn't ready to go. He was scratched yesterday. He would get the start against the lefty if he was good to go. Instead, you go with Siri over Chaz McCormick. Another curious move
by
Dusty.
What has he done just please tell me this, Jeremy. Aside from anything else that I'm about to bring up for you. And by the way, Chaz had another hit yesterday. What has Siri done that has in any way, shape, or form motivated you to say that guy should be in the lineup in the most important game of the season today? I have seen nothing. If you want to tell me that he shook his pom-poms and did his handshakes and pulled his arrow out and shot it when Altuve hit the home run, that ain't good enough. Because if he's not hitting the baseball and he looked completely overmatched in the game that he started, okay, there's no reason for him to be in the starting lineup. Put him in as a defensive replacement, I'm with that. Just like you said about Castro. Late in the game, you want speed in the outfield and a guy that really can cover some ground and looks like he knows how to play the Fenway walls. Put him out there, but you don't start him in Game 5.
No, I'm not a fan of it either. He's a mistake waiting to happen. I don't like Jose Siri as a player, I'll be honest with you. Ooh. I think that he has some talent. I don't think he's like this all-world potential guy like people like to tell you. He's 26 years old. He's a journeyman. He's been in several organizations. Nothing about him screams top prospect. Like, he has a little bit of pop. He's fast. He's an athletic guy, but he's also a mistake waiting to happen. Like, he had a couple of good plays in center field in Game 3 where he started. He played the ball well off the wall. Congratulations. He had the nice sliding catch. You know what else he tried to do? He tried to tell Yuler Gurriel to take second base whenever the ball was in the catcher's hands after he was backing up a back pick at first base. Like, that guy is a mistake waiting to happen. And honestly, he terrifies me in center field. He terrifies me whenever he's roaming center field behind Fromber Valdez.
Well, I will tell you this, that the one play that I'm talking about possibly saved them a run because he played the carom off the wall perfectly. He hit Correa with the cutoff. And they held, I believe it was Bogarts at third base. Other than that, I'm here to listen to everything that you have to say about him in this series because I'm looking at Chaz McCormick and I'm looking at his numbers, and his average says 400. How's that doing for you?
He had a walk yesterday,
too. Would you rather have that in your lineup or would you rather have Siri, who doesn't even really, I mean, who's the only claim to fame right now other than one relay I'm talking about is the fact that Joe Buck can't stop talking about him, thinking he's funny, looking for two shows nightly, tip your bartenders and waitstaff with his comedic routine about, hey, Siri. Other than that, no reason for that dude to be in the lineup today.
It was hilarious when Joe Buck was talking about Siri, and he said, Dusty Baker loves this kid, and as soon as he said he loves this kid, they flashed his age on the screen, and it said 26 years old. That's not a kid. That's not a kid in Major League Baseball. 713-780-3776. We'll get to some of your calls a little bit later in hour number two of the show, the 1 o'clock hour. If you want to hang tight or you want to call us back, we'll get to your call. 713-780-3776 in the 1 o'clock hour. But when we return, we're going to be joined by Houston Astro historian Mike Acosta. He joins us next. Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Before we go to the break, I want to tell you about the good people at Frankie's Italian Kitchen. I'm telling you, if you are craving really good, fresh, authentic Italian food. No, not the kind that has the name of the restaurant you're familiar with on the sign. But when you go in, you realize it's commercialized and it's all a chain and the food isn't prepared fresh and it's not the same as the menu you were used to. Then I'm telling you, this is where you need to go. Frankie's Italian Kitchen TX.com. Primarily for the West Katy, Fulcher, Richmond, Sugarland areas. But if you want to drive a little bit, it is worth your time, and it definitely saves you money because it is a fantastic environment. They used to be known for their pizza, and pizza was in their name because of the fact that their pizza oven is fantastic. The crust is really nice and crispy, but all the ingredients on the top are fresh, and they're all blended together, and the pizzas are fantastic. And they also have wings, too, but they're really known for all of their Italian dishes. That's why they renamed it Frankie's Italian Kitchen TX.com. Chris Smith, the owner, he's also the chef. He prepares it all fresh. He gets the he calls to College Station and gets his Italian sausage. He gets the Wisconsin cheese, the fresh produce. He puts it all together, and he not only has everything on the menu, but if you go to Frankie's Italian Kitchen TX.com, you'll find out the special dishes that he's making just for that week or that day, and they have them until they run out of them, and they are worth every bit of it. From the stroganoff to the lasagna to all the different authentic Italian dishes, it's going to leave your wallet and your stomach full, and it's going to leave your family happy because they got everything that they needed in a comfortable environment. Check them out today, Frankie's Italian Kitchen, TX.com. Tell them Joel Blank sent you by.
ESPN 97.5. Please stand by. Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
It's Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5, Joel Blank, Jeremy Branham. Let's go out now to the HR&P guest line. Mike Acosta, Houston Astro baseball historian, is joining us. Thanks for coming on the show, Mike. Mike, looking at Altuve, he hits his 21st postseason home run yesterday. It's the most of any infielder in Major League Baseball history. It's the third most all-time. What about the feats that Jose Altuve is accomplishing in his baseball career?
Man, I got to say, hey, thanks for having me on, first off. But Altuve is done and is doing things that are just unprecedented in Astros history. I mean, if you compare him, the only guy you can really compare him to is Craig Biggio. And Craig Biggio is kind of the all-time Iron Man of the franchise, you know, with just everything that he did, the 3,000 hits and the amount of extra base hits and the doubles and everything else that he did. But Altuve has won batting titles. You know, he's hit multiple seasons of 200 or more hits. And now, you know, all of this other stuff that he's doing in the postseason really has just exceeded some of the things that we have seen in the past. And it doesn't belittle everything else that we saw from these great players, but Altuve is really putting himself on a platform that has been unlike any other player in franchise history. I mean, I was looking at this one deal. He now had, you know, last night's home run was 2 years to the day that he hit the game-winning home run against the Yankees, and he had another crucial home run last night to keep them in the ALCS with Boston. But he has he's 3 game-tying or go ahead postseason home runs in the eighth inning or later, and that's tied for second for all time. I mean, that's just really something. Altuve has really, really put a stamp. When you want to talk about what the Astros are, you have to put Altuve's name in there. There's no doubt.
Well, Mike, and I appreciate you being on because I've been a follower from afar for a long time, and I appreciate all you have done in terms of memorializing and historically putting into perspective a lot of Astros history. But skip the Astros perspective for a second on Altuve. I'm interested in your opinion on how, you know, look at every night on a night-by-night basis, we're talking about another record or another top three in baseball history moment from Jose Altuve. And really, everybody still questions if he's a Hall of Famer someday, and you mentioned Craig Biggio. To me, it's a no-brainer based on everything you said with the batting titles and all the other things that he accomplished. And really, it's unfortunate from a social media perspective. If there wasn't a John Boy and there wasn't a buzzer story, I don't know that we'd even have to question any of this, but it seems like now we have to ask the question about the long-term implications or the long-term ramifications of being somehow connected to all of that, the cheating when he hits.
Well, you know what? Regardless of anything that went on, and I think it's pretty well known and pretty well accepted that Jose Altuve was against anything that was going on that was considered suspicious. You know, I don't like to use the C word in there, but he was against that, and it really goes against who he is. I've been around Jose Altuve for the better part of his first half of his career, or his entire career. I say first half because I kind of feel like he's going to play 20 years in the majors, but it just goes against who he is. Altuve is great physically. He's tough mentally. He doesn't ever give up. He's very resilient. That whole persona is what engulfs the Astros. He is really who the Astros look up to and respect. And anything else that's said against him, it really just doesn't make any sense. And I think the fact that he's been able to put up these numbers, impress, you know, come in the clutch, still come up with all these records after all of this mess was put out there, a couple of years ago, it just shows that he's a great player. And in my opinion, you know, if he stays on this path, he's a future Hall of Famer. And I don't like to throw that around a lot, but he's on that track. And there's no way of denying that for anybody. Anybody who looks at baseball from an unbiased perspective should say that Jose Altuve is certainly on a Hall of Fame track. It doesn't guarantee he still has to stay healthy. Still needs to play a lot more years. But he is certainly trending that way.
Astros historian Mike Acosta joining us on the HRMP guest line. You can follow Mike at Astros Talk. Mike, watching the Fox broadcast yesterday, you noticed the stat that Yuli Gurriel has the most base hits in Fenway Park history. How is that even possible?
Well, you know, Yuli Gurriel, you would have thought, how is it even possible for Yuli Gurriel to have the impact that he's had on the Astros? I mean, he came out of nowhere, you know, just in the 2017 season when there was a signing that was announced that the Astros were bringing in Yuli Gurriel. That was a totally unexpected piece of the pie that just, you know, we didn't know what that was going to do at the time. But here he is. He's done all these spectacular things. I mean, the guy is very smart. He approaches his at-bats very well. He has a very quick speed, bat speed on inside the box, and he's a good base runner. He thinks, sees the whole game as the big picture. And so I think that is partially why he's been able to put together, and very quietly, too. Kind of like, Michael Brantley is kind of the quiet but carries a big stick type of guy. Yuli Gurriel is like that as well. You don't hear him very boisterous, and you see him celebrating and everything, but he kind of calmly does it, and he does it fundamentally well. And I think that is the consistency that you really need in order to have numbers like that.
Mike, I compare you favorably with Jim Foley of the Rockets in terms of forever in your career, you historically kept track of all these different moments in the history of the Astros. But it also, we saw the evolution of history turn into memorabilia, turn into when you started doing all the things that the Astros were very, very savvy about doing in terms of from foul balls to key moments in history. When did you see it become the next step for a historian to be able to say, hey, it's one thing to say on this date in Astros history, this happened, but get that ball, get that bat, do these things. We need to keep track of all these things. And where the hell are all of them? Because there's so many that make up Astros history.
Well, you have to look at it from a very big picture standpoint. And so, Astros history, baseball history, no matter what team or sport you're talking about, there's always the information, there's a timeline, there are the great moments, but then you start thinking about the associated artifacts. So if I could go back in time and, you know, go to April 10th, 1962, the first game in franchise history, what would we have targeted in that game? Or say April 9th, 1965, the first exhibition game at the Astrodome against the Yankees, what would we have done there? the Nolan Ryan no-hitter in 1981 or any other type of memorable moment that happened in franchise history, what would we have done? And that's the way I always approached it was, if we think 5 or 10 years down the line, what is going to be important to try to tell the story of these great moments that are happening in franchise history? And you have to have a very proactive plan. You have to think ahead in terms of what the player's going to want, what the team might be able to keep, and then what the fans are probably going to have access to from a retail standpoint with the Astros Authentics program. And those were the three main components that I always use when thinking about what we were going to do, and especially in the postseason. I always approach the postseason with a full pregame, in-game, and postgame type of plan. And so you just have to anticipate these things because it's not just the information that you're going to see in books or online or in photos. It's also going to be the physical artifacts that are going to be able to tell the story down the line for other generations.
Well, and my question then becomes, if it's so-and-so with his name on the bat and he gets the big hit, who gets the bat? And then what about the superstitious baseball player that says, yeah, you can have the bat, but it's got more hits left in it. I don't want to give it up just yet.
Well, we always had a plan in place for that. And, excuse me, we would never authenticate a bat. We would never want to interrupt, you know, like you said, if there's more hits, if the player feels that bat is still good. We never wanted to take that bat out of service, but if a home run was hit, a key home run, something that was historical, memorable, we would pull the bat aside and have the authenticator tag it right then and there. And then we would track it for the remainder of its use. And then when it was cracked eventually, or maybe it wasn't, we would take it out of service later on. But we always did that. Same thing with a jersey. We could track a jersey from game to game. Same thing with a helmet. The only thing that we really couldn't track multiple times was from game to game was a baseball because the average lifespan of a baseball is about 6 pitches. So it's going to be fouled out or whatever. It's going to come out of the game. It's going to you're not going to be able to use it as much as you do a bat or a jersey or a hat or a helmet or a glove of some sort. So we had procedures in place to track game use on different items, and then if the player wanted to keep it, that was always the number one thing. If it meant a lot to the player personally, the team would always give it to the player. And then we would try to negotiate some other artifacts to keep for the team archives, and then some other things, like I said earlier, for people to buy at retail that are kind of connected to that moment. And that's really the way we approached it.
I know we're running short on time, but there's two follow-ups that, because this intrigues and fascinates the hell out of me. One, Yuli put the ball in his back pocket when they won the World Series, and he seems to do that. Is that something that he keeps or you go get? And then after doing this for so many years, are you a collector as well, or are you just dedicated to keeping it all for the franchise?
Well, for as far as Yuli goes, he pretty much kept it. And that was at a level between him and Jim Crane, whether or not he went to give it back. So I just kind of push back. My goal is just to tag and items that we could get during the ball games, and I'm not really doing that anymore because my situation changed with the Astros, and I'm more of a contract historian now. But that's the way we're approaching there. And then from the other question, with as far as a collector, I love to collect old stuff. I have a really top notch Astrodome collection that has old scoreboard bulbs, and I have Shooting Star uniforms and. I have Astrodome seats from every level in the dome. The older stuff really fascinates me. I really like it. It kind of ties to my youth, and I really, really love having that. So from that standpoint, I do like to collect, but a lot of the older stuff mainly.
And it doesn't seem like it's more player-related in terms of, like, value. It's terms of sentimental value.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, I think anybody collects anything, it's going to be something that they hold personally important. They have sentimental value to it, and this is no different.
That's awesome.
Mike, great stuff. Thanks for hopping on. Enjoy Game 5 later this afternoon.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mike Acosta, Astros historian. You can follow him on Twitter. He's got really good stuff on Twitter, too, at Astros Talk. 713-780-ESPN if you want to weigh in on this Astros Red Sox series. 713-780-3776. When we come back, apparently we just bang on Dusty Baker the whole show, so we'll do the opposite coming up next. Credit to Dusty with the management of this bullpen. We tell you what we mean next. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Get low when the whistle goes.
Real fun. Sports. ESPN 97.5.